I'm glad that you're with us today. I get to work with Stephen. Is that not amazing? Some of you preachers right here are just like, oh man, and you know. And then some of you have your song leaders with you, and you're like, nah, it's gay. But the thing I want to just share real quickly about Steve and Alicia and their boy, many of you have known them for a long, long time, and you've known, like Steve's singing ability and so on, but what I want you to know is behind the scenes, he's a great leader of people.
Amen.
And he's a wonderful theological thinker, and he can stand working with me, see, so I'll run down to his office all lit up and say, man, what do you think? And he'll always just let me come in, sit, work through it together, and so it's a wonderful partnership. 37 years ago, I met the love of my life, and she's here today, Susan, and so I'd like you to welcome her. In the book, if you pick up the book, she wrote all the study guides. And so part of what we were hoping for is that someone would go through the book and look for what stood out to her instead of just looking for what, you know, I was looking for. And I think that makes for a more balanced study. What I want to do is spend a little time today thinking through the introduction to this love first. And some of you were here a few years ago when I introduced some of this, and I was kind of on the front end of learning the theology of this. The way we'll do the 3 days is today we'll talk about the crisis, and then tomorrow we'll talk about the creed. I think that's going to be fun. And then the final day we'll talk about culture and how we engage and how we can make a wonderful difference in the world. Each day, Stephen's going to lead us in worship, and then I'll spend a little bit of time engaging our conversation. And then different conversation partners are going to join me. Like today, Stephen and Tim Anderson are going to join you for this. Another day, my daughter and a couple other people are going to join us. And what we'll do is we'll talk. And so what I'd like you to be doing is as you're processing this, just if you have a question or you haven't thought about it, then write it down. And then a little later on, then we'll discuss that. The other thing I want to put at the front end of this is I do not expect you to agree. I don't think that's necessary. In fact, I don't think agreement is necessary for unity. I think unity is what we do when we don't agree, and we know how to stay together when we don't agree. But I have a caveat. Don't be lazy. If you disagree, don't retreat to what you already think. Right? If you disagree, you know what I would expect of you? The same thing I would expect of me. Research. Go research. One of the things that's happened over the last 20 years is as I've been growing in this journey, I've had lots of people tell me, Don, you are dead wrong. And what it's made me do is just go back and look at things differently. One of our elders at North Atlanta, Fernando Nasmith, and his wife, Donna, are great, very dear friends of ours. And so 20 years ago, Donna gave me an article. And she said, I want you to read this article. And the article had something to do with race relations and so on. So I went and read the article. I came back. She said, what did you think about that? I thought it was wonderful. She said, that's the problem. You think it's wonderful. I said, oh. I said, well, what's wrong with it? She said, I want you to go back and read it knowing that someone else doesn't think it's wonderful. See what you can discover now. Because your first time through, you thought it was great. But now you know someone you love doesn't think it's great. So now what would you do? That changed my life. And I'm hoping we'll do some of that now. The last thing I want to say is this. I just love the church. I think it's wonderful. And when my dad passed away a few years ago at the funeral, someone said to me, you know what made your dad stand out? And I said, well, many things, I'm sure, but tell me what you're thinking. He said he came to the church through Christ. And he just loves it. He just loved it the way Jesus loved it. And so the church, and some of you know my dad's story, it was not always a friendly relationship with the church. But he always loved it and thought so highly of the church. And he instilled that in me all the way through. So I love the church, and I believe without question that the church is God's answer. We can make a huge difference in how this world is moving forward. So that's part of what we're going to talk about. What I want to do in this first section is I want to talk a little bit about the crisis. And what I want to do is just take us on a journey. You remember Kent Brantley? You remember Kent? So Kent is the Ebola doctor. You remember he became famous over in Sierra Leone. He was over there with a team from Samaritan's First. He contracted Ebola. You remember this in 2014. I actually met Kent when he was 8 years old. We lived in Indiana. His family, some of you know them, they're from Indianapolis. His dad was an elder in the church there, so we went down and met this wonderful family. He's got 5 siblings. Wonderful people. Of course, at 8 years old, we didn't know that eventually he would become the face of Ebola around the world. This is when he was arriving. That's him coming out of the ambulance there. That's a little closer shot. This is his co-worker, Nancy Reichel, that was also escorted home. Just try to process. Look at that picture and try to imagine what was going on in their minds. Right? Now, you remember that there were people in our country that did not want them to come home. Remember that? There were people that thought, you know what, even if they're Americans, they chose to go over there. If they chose to go and they got sick over there, let them die over there. Now, that didn't set well with most of us. I know that most of us were like, as afraid as I am, I just can't stand the thought of just saying to some American citizen, well, you know, it is what it is, you know. I don't think most of us felt, but how many of you were nervous about the disease and the impact of it and all of that? I think that's normal, right? But we brought him home. This is him after he's in Emory for several days in Atlanta, coming through. That was pretty exciting. You remember he and his wife Amber got to meet the president. He was one of the people of the year. Here's what I want you to notice about this: people were dying in mass. They didn't know why, and those who were supposed to help appeared to be the cause. What was happening, and you can read about the history of this, is people in the western end of Africa there, around the world, they were actually storming hospitals and pulling their family members out because they thought they were getting sick at the hospital. So the very people that were there with the cure, they thought they were the carriers of the disease. So these doctors had to go out into these villages, village after village, hut after hut, house after house, and try to win back the confidence of the people. What I believe with all my heart is this is the crisis of the church. The church in America is not viewed as the cure, and we're not viewed as the solution. I just want to be honest about that. We're not. Our communities don't think that way. Let me give you a recent example. Remember back at 9/11, what happened the following Sunday? How many of you remember? I mean, the following Wednesday night, but even the following Sunday. What happened with churches? They were packed. Were they not? Okay, think about last summer. We had killings in Baton Rouge, Minneapolis, and the shootings in Dallas. What did the churches look like? Not a blip. The average church, especially those that are predominantly wrapped in my color, it was barely a blip. Giant crisis in the country. But it was Twitter and Facebook that owned the conversation, not the church. Because people didn't see the church as providing credible solutions. I just want you to think about that. Just 16 years out from 9/11, we have a giant crisis, and the church isn't on the radar. How many of you at work met people after the struggles last summer, and people said, man, let me know what your church is doing, because I really just need a place to go to get some answers? Okay, we live in the same world. I think the tragedy that we're facing is that people see the church as sick, and we don't. I did some research, a ton of research on this, and what's fascinating is the church gives itself better marks than the world does. The church says, we're in tune, we got it going on. But the world isn't responding the same way. So up here on the left, I want you to look at the 4 symptoms that we're struggling with. The thing we're struggling is the best people fit in with me. This is a normal sociological and anthropological approach where my tribe is the better tribe. Right? So the people who are with me and the people that think like me are the better among us. Okay? The next thing is the smartest people think like me. So, you can kind of find this funny. Think about last fall in the election. So, we have people in our church who would say things like, well, I just can't even see how somebody could vote Republican and be a Christian. And then I'd get out of that meeting, go get in the car, and go to lunch with somebody. I just get to see how somebody can vote Democrat and just be a Christian. And I was like, well, it's kind of funny because you guys are sitting like 8 feet from each other on Sunday morning. And you're like, hey, brother, how you doing? Hey, brother, how you doing? But see, the reality is we were kind of living under, I have to know you less to love you more. Don't tell me what you think politically. Don't tell me what you think religiously. Don't tell me what you think about the issues, because if you did, I would love you less, because the smartest people think like me. Number three, the safest people fear what I fear. So the people that I feel comfortable around are the ones that are as fearful as I am about the issues I fear. Okay? So the idea, one of our young people that's in our college-age ministry, he had dropped out of church, and I've known this kid since he was, like, in the first grade. I noticed that immediately he's missing. His parents go to our church. His grandparents go to our church. So I call him up. I go to have lunch with him. And I said, tell me what's going on. And he kind of hedged a little bit, you know. And finally we got around to it. They'd been at a family gathering. And one of his older relatives had gone on a rant about the reason that the United States is going down the tube is because of the gays. That's why we're going down the tube. And he said that was it, because I got so sick of hearing about love at church and hate at home. He was that blunt. He said, you can't tell me, with all of the sin in the United States, that the one that finally pushed God over the ledge was the gays. And I thought, well, that's fair. That's fair. But see, to him, in his mind, he thought to himself, I actually don't want to fear the people you fear. I don't want to fear what you fear. But if I don't, then somehow I'm not safe. Now look at the last one. The good people are good like me. Now those of you in here that know a lot of Bible study, you know this is the Romans chapter 3 problem, Romans 1 through 3. Where the people that are the Gentiles, well, the Jews should have been good like us, or if you're Jew, well then the Gentiles should be good like us, remember? And what is the big crushing blow that Paul delivers? Well, there's none good, no, not one. Right? But what do we hold to secretly underneath? Yeah, the good people are good like me. Right? Isn't this part of what we struggle with? So I want you to look at these four symptoms. And then what I want you to do is think about how this could influence the way people view the church. And think about how it influences how people talk about issues. So one of the fascinating things last summer was we had an opportunity for terrific insight. How many of you are from the Dallas-Fort Worth area? Would you raise your hands? Okay. So last summer, when we had this horrific situation with the shooting of the five police officers. Do you remember this? Do you remember the Dallas police chief's name? David Brown. Do you know this guy's story? So David Brown's police chief, this year, of course he's now retired, but this year, he received the top award that they give police in the nation. This guy was amazing, and he was a powerful leader. Now, those of you that don't remember, he's also African-American. So one of the things that happened along the journey was it came out that his own son had died in a police shootout. His own son, not a policeman, died in a shootout with police, but he's the police chief, so clearly, he's all about supporting the police. But here's what happened. As he gained more opportunity to speak, he started sharing what it was like to be a black citizen. And now we had a weird convergence. You know what the weird convergence was, right? You have a blue life and a black life in the same person. You've got a black man in a blue uniform, right? So how many of you remember the false dichotomy that was set up that either black lives matter or blue lives matter? Yeah, but what do you do with David Brown? He's going to be like, I'm going to tell you, they both matter, because that would be me. Right? And how many of you are from Charlotte or Charlotte-Mecklenburg? Any of you from there, from North Carolina? Okay, all right. So you also know Kurt Putney. So he's the police chief there. It's another situation similar, right? So Kurt Putney is a black man in a blue uniform. So one of the things that Kurt Putney shared, and if you listen to this guy speak, he's all about the police force that he leads, and he's a great leader. Then he said, here's something I want you to know. Even today, now remember this is a police chief. He said, even today when the blue lights come on, there is a gut reaction inside of me that goes back to when I was 8 years old. Now that is a police chief. So one of the things we have to start asking ourselves is, do I like the blue hat of a black man? Like, or could I like this man, right? This whole stuff. So I started having conversations about this, and people said to me, well, I'm just colorblind. Like, that's a good thing. They would say it with confidence, I'm colorblind. Like, it was a good thing. And so I would say to them, well, tell me about that. Well, I don't see color. I thought, then why are you saying what you're saying? Because if you don't see color, well then, you're having a colorblind, right? Well, no. You know what I mean. Well, I would love to hear what you mean. I'd like to hear about that. Well, you know, I just, when I choose my friends or whatever, I just don't even think about color. So I said, well, here's what I'm wondering. I'm wondering if your black and brown friends like that. Like, do they like you saying to them, I don't see your color? Because you understand what's inherent in that? If I do see it, it's bad. We never say that if it's good, right?
No one ever says, you know, I go to a rose garden and it drives me nuts that there's color. I wish they were all gray. I just can't stand that there's red and yellow.
And when you say to someone, I don't notice your color, that's kind of like saying to someone, I can't really notice all of you. I can't really embrace all of you, right? It's kind of fascinating. So we have five children, and we have a daughter that's 27, and some of you know her and thank you for your great love for her. She just arrived in Los Angeles, so we're very excited about them getting here. She has four older brothers, okay? And so Amy's 27, and then she has four older brothers. So one of her older brothers has brown skin. Beautiful brown skin. And so Susan and I have been on a fascinating journey, all right? So if you kind of look at Susan over here, right? Now try to imagine going to parent-teacher conferences with a son that has brown skin, right? Right? So we're sitting there in a conference one day, and this teacher's fidgeting because she's got a question she wants to ask. And finally, she looked at Susan and says, do you have other children? And Susan said, yes. And she said, are they all like Jerome? And she said, no, one's a girl. See, what the lady couldn't do is her imagination couldn't move outside of the idea that different color skin is God's wonderful idea. Right? He's just so good at it. And kind of what he was thinking, if you read Ephesians chapter 3, and we'll get into that on another day, is he was kind of thinking, here's what I'm going to do. I am going to make my world in a way that represents me. I'm going to make it show my character. And then you all in the church, you're going to show my wisdom by your ability to represent me in how you relate with each other. Isn't that a beautiful quest for us as Christians? So, you guys remember, how many remember Ruby Bridges speaking here last year? Well, yeah, it was incredible. So that launched this amazing, crazy friendship that has been going on now for the last year. So we brought her to Atlanta. She did a great job sharing with us. We really had a terrific time with her. But you see those tears, those of you that were here last year, you'll remember what those were about. the death of her son. And here's what she shared. She said, the problem is not white, black, or brown. It's a problem of good and evil. When Dylan Roof, a white man, sits for an hour in a prayer meeting and then stands up and shoots the very people that welcomed him, that's evil. But the person who murdered my son was the same color as my son. The issue was not skin color. It was good and evil. Right? You remember she shared that here. So here's something I want you to think about. How many of you have struggled with the reality that sometimes the way that people are presented to us, we do associate negative connotations with some skin color and accent and language and last name? Have you noticed that? And we associate fear, right? Have you noticed this as well? So one of the things that was fascinating with our son was one day he and two of his brothers were in a car together, and they were driving up by the high school, and they get pulled over for a license plate light being out. So they get pulled over, and ends up being no citation, but our son Jerome was the only one that ended up in the patrol car. But he wasn't driving. He's in the back seat. And they pulled him out. And his driver's license is the same as his brother's, like, you know, McLaughlin. But he's the only one that ended up in there for questioning. So it was kind of weird. It's like, what was that about? Well, I knew that the African-American brothers and sisters in our church knew what that was about. And they were trying to help mentor Susan and I through this. But we didn't fully know what that was about. You get where I'm coming from? So then the next one, he's on his way to meet a longtime mentor. He's in a suit. He's on his way over to Cobb County, west part of Atlanta. And he gets pulled over again. It's raining. Pull him over, out of the car. They search his car with a canine unit. There is no citation. There's no nothing. And finally, when they're done, he said to the policeman, why did you pull me over? And he said, because you do not belong in this part of town, boy. Now, you understand, I'm not painting police officers with that guy's brush. You understand? I'm not. But what I'm suggesting is, it is a weird feeling. We've never had that happen with our other three boys. The third one in our community, Dunwee, he went to pick up Brian Harper. He's a professional basketball player. He's 6'10". Jerome went to pick him up downtown. He was doing a basketball event. They come up to our area. So by the time they get up to our area, after it's all done that night, it's about 12 o'clock, 12:15. They get pulled over by a policeman. Policeman comes up and tells them to exit the vehicle. Now, you understand, there's nothing other than that. Well, when Brian exits, he's 6'10". So they strip-tie both of them behind their back in the back of the vehicle. Now, bear in mind, I just need to skip to the end. There's no citation. So why is this happening? And why are our other children out till all hours enjoying themselves and this isn't happening? Oh, and I didn't mention this. Both of them had apartments in Dunwood, our son and Brian. So it's just weird. So I called the mayor's office, and we're very active in our community, so I called the mayor's office. I get the mayor pro tem. He's a friend of ours, and he comes over to my office. I bring him into my office, and I point to a family picture, and I said, I want you to study that family picture. All of them are my children. All of them. And I want you to study that picture as I tell you the story. And I told him what I just told you. Oh, man, I'm so sorry. That should never happen. I'll have the chief call you. I said, don't have the chief call me. In fact, don't have the chief call anyone. Have your officers call our son. They're going to have to figure out how to get to know the people that live here and stop imagining evil associated with skin color. You feel where I'm coming from on this? Now, before we move on, I want to do something really, really important. If you take notes or whatever, I want you to do this. I want you to look at a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. How many of you have looked at this book by Tatum? Great book, isn't it? Okay, not a theological book, but it's a very important book. And I'm going to give you kind of a nutshell. What Kahneman argues is this. We have two systems of thinking, fast and slow. Fast is our impulse. Slow is thoughtfulness. He suggests you might never, ever get past your impulses. Right? Agreed? We might never get past our impulses. But the question is, what do we do with them? So let me give you an example. So when we were young married, one of the things that surprised me, I became a Christian like 11 months before we got married. And I kind of had an unrealistic view of what it would mean to become a Christian. And I think a lot of us do. And so we're married for a while, and I notice I'm still struggling with lust, and so I talked to Susan about it. I knew it would hurt her feelings, but I just thought she's the closest person to me. We'll work through this together, right? So one day I said to her, I said, Susan, I can tell you right now, I don't know how other men are. I don't know. I can't speak for them. But for me, I know if a woman is going to turn my crank from 100 yards. What do I mean by that? I know if a woman is going to excite my lustful attention from a long way off. And you may notice that I notice. Ladies, have you ever noticed that a guy is noticing? Shake your head yes or maybe, it'll go faster. Okay? You know what I said to her? Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Notice what I do next. Because you're going to see me turn away, and you're going to see me take all my thoughts and make them obedient to Christ. 2 Corinthians 10:4-5. What Kamen argues is this. If you grew up with impulses where you picture people of a certain skin color as maybe more dangerous or more fearful or not as smart or whatever, however that went for you, you realize you might struggle with that your whole life. So the question really isn't fighting your impulse. The question is a discipleship question. What will you do with your impulse? Will you take that thought and make it obedient to Christ? Does that make some sense? It made a lot of sense to me because I had a lot of impulses. One time, Susan and I were in Hawaii, and we were at the Pearl Harbor Memorial, right? And I think this was around 1995. I was raised in an extremely patriotic family. So when we went there, how many of you have been in that? Whew, it's an experience, isn't it? Well, at that time, we had a family nearby us who was from Japan, and their understanding of that memorial was very thin. They had almost no understanding of the memorial. And so the park ranger, it wasn't a park ranger, it's the Navy, right? Is that right? Is it the Navy that covers that memorial? I don't remember. Anyway, this guy in uniform took about explaining it. And let me put it a different way. He explained it in no uncertain terms. And my wife and I were watching people kind of standing up straight. I mean, we were standing up straight because he made it crystal clear. This is not a tourist attraction. Right? Now, I got a question for you. When should Americans get over Pearl Harbor? When should we kind of get over it? Or what about the whole 9/11 thing? Are we far enough out that we should get over it? Shake your head yes, Romania. Should we get over it?
No.
Right? So when people have suffered, does it really make any sense to say to them, you just need to get over it? That doesn't make sense, does it? Right? So why would we do that in cases where people have suffered things because of their skin color? It doesn't make sense to say to people, just get over that. So this is part of how we expand our empathy. So now I want you to look at this. Remember King said this? This was in a speech in 1963 about the most segregated hour. How many of you remember that, basically? Here's what I want you to see from the rest of the speech. He said, now I'm not saying that society must sit down and wait on a spiritual and moribund church, as we've seen so often. I think it should have started with the church, but since it didn't start with the church, our society needed to move on. Now, bear in mind, that's 1963. So what we don't want to do is we don't want to find ourselves in the same spot. Agreed? What we don't want to do is in 2017, we don't want this to still be in our story. But it is part of our story. This is interesting. Library research, you'll find some of this research in the book. Churches in America are too segregated, 50% agree. 44% disagree. My church needs to become more ethnically diverse. 53% disagree. I don't think so. Our church is doing enough to be ethnically diverse. And 67% say, yep. Yeah. This is fascinating. There are 330,000 churches in America. 86% do not share the worship and fellowship experience with people of other colors and cultures. And 2.5% are intentionally seeking to share their worship and fellowship experience with people of other colors. Are you watching this craziness? It's crazy, isn't it? That we would be the people that would be God's answer to all this division in our society. And we're kind of struggling. How many of you notice we're kind of struggling up here? 86% of our churches aren't doing it. In the Lifeway research, that number says, and we're okay with it. Well, we're missing out, friends. Because in our nation, what's one of our biggest issues? How do we get people together? And the church knows how to do this? And we're not doing it? You say, well, I feel weird about those numbers up there. Here's the fascinating thing. There are actually a little over 8% of the churches. How many of you do analysis for business and so on? You know, critical mass, 20% critical mass. The way that they decide this is a church 20% a minority? So an ethnically diverse church is a 20% minority using the critical mass theory. Okay? A little over 8% are that way, but 6% of those, 6%, outside of that 8%, 6% of them are actually, the neighborhood's just changing. So they are either black and they're becoming Latino, or they're white, they're becoming black. You see what I'm saying? The neighborhood's changing. So they're not actually doing it on purpose. Only 2.5% are doing it on purpose. But the world wants to see it. And we have an opportunity to do it. So what I'd like you to think about is this. What if we could become the solution? And go out into our neighborhoods and begin living out the solution. So, if you guys are about ready to come up, and Stephen, can you guys set up a couple of chairs? So, in our neighborhood, when I moved to Atlanta, our church was about 95 or 97% people wrapped in my question. And wonderful people. And so I said to the elders, are you guys primarily white on purpose, or do you just not know how to reach out to people that aren't white? And they were like, no, we just know how to reach out to people that aren't white. I said, well, what if we learned that together, right? So we decided to learn it together. So we went out in our neighborhood, this is 20 years ago, and we began knocking on doors. You know what's really fascinating? We found out that our neighborhood did not look like us. Already? They already didn't look like us. So people lived near us, but they didn't see us as a place that would be shared space. Right? Now, real quick, how many of you think, if somebody asked you, as a Christian, do you think that little brown children and little light-skinned children should share education? What would your answer be?
Yes.
Well, yes, of course. Well, that wasn't the answer of Topeka, Kansas in 1954 with the Brown versus the Board of Education, was it? And that was not the answer 6 years later when New Orleans schools were still resisting that and Ruby Bridges went to school, right? But guess what? Do you know who the people were that went with them? Let me move up to this. This is kind of fascinating. I'm just going to scoop this through this because we're going to have 3 days together. Do you guys know who these are? You know who's on the left? That's Pam Foreman, and that's her dad, Lloyd. Lloyd was a minister in New Orleans. And on the second day of school, that when they integrated school, when Ruby Bridges did, he said, we're going to school. They didn't have any protection. And on the right, that's Yolanda Gabrielle. And she said, we're doing the same thing. So these two families just said, you know what we're going to do? We're actually going to go to school with Ruby. And that was me, too. I think this is fascinating. This is Ruby and Pam now. But this was Ruby and Pam then. Do you think we can do this? This isn't about integration and segregation. This is about people sharing. I have a granddaughter, right? And I'm teaching my granddaughter how to share. How about you? Don't you think teaching your children how to share is a good thing? So don't you think teaching them to share schools is a good thing? And to share jobs is a good thing? And to share church is a good thing? How many of you think we should share as Christians? I think we should share. You feel how the conversation shifts when we put it in the light of our wonderful Savior? Isn't it beautiful? He knows what he's doing, right? You know why? Because he's right about everything. Right? Okay, so let's take some time have a conversation. And I asked Tim to come up here. He's always up for anything. And Stephen actually read the book. So outside of the publisher and Susan, Stephen was the first one to read the whole book. And so first of all, what I want to do is take a moment and you guys just give a little reflection on what we talked about. Take a couple minutes. You give a quick reflection, and then Tim can give it.
That, you know, as a father of three beautiful brown boys myself, it was just refreshing. You know, and we'll, I'm sure, over the next few days, see this more. But for as difficult a situation as you may feel that we're in, as we are actually in, it's not new. The answer was Jesus and will continue to be. And it's funny, as I heard Bob Goff talk today, you know, it was lots of humor and lots of things that he used to say, this is simple and it's hard. But it's a road that we're called to by Christ. And so what we've seen so far, and especially, you know, as I read the book, I found myself laughing also. And my instructions, you know, to my boys are how, to the best of my ability, to have them not, you know, no offense, end up like Jerome. I don't want them pulled. Right. That's part of, you know what I mean? And so, and you know, my boys, they will run and attack anybody who doesn't care. They don't care.
Matter of fact, here's some of their relatives sitting over here, Uncle Red, right over here. You can see what color skin they're wrapping.
They attack them all the time. So that's the way my legs and I raise my boys. So,
Well, I had an opportunity actually to read just a small excerpt of your book. And I think that with the presentation that we've heard today, I can second with what you're saying in regards to the reality. This is not a new instance in the lives of African-American people. What you mentioned about your sons resonated with me. I had the opportunity last summer when this happened to share with some of my white friends and the predominantly white churches had the platform to be able to talk about what was going on. One of the things that I shared, which reflects what you're talking about here, is that my friend, who's also a preacher in a predominantly white neighborhood, predominantly white church, mentioned that when he's pulled over by the cops for whatever reason, his biggest worry is how much the ticket will be. And when I'm pulled over, my biggest worry is if I'll live. And that's a very, very different experience, and it brings on a lot of different feelings and emotions. And your book communicates and conveys the idea of God's grace and love, and yet there is a carnal part of me that says, "But I'm tired," you know. But the spiritual side of me says, "But I must." And that's a struggle because we're often asked to get over it. And so we're trying to reconcile how to do that and still be kind and still be mature and still be godly at the same time. So this has certainly resonated with me.
Can we, do you have a question that you'd like to address to the three of us in the conversation?
What can we do?
Say again?
What can we do?
Okay. Question: what can we do? Now we'll address some of that, you know, in the next few days. But let's talk. What would you guys respond to this?
One of the things that you can do is one of the things that's most fun for me. It's not for everybody. So I married somebody whom what I'm about to say is it's not fun for them, but this is very powerful.
Hang out.
So I'm looking in the audience, right? I like this. So let me embarrass somebody else. There's a lady right here I'm looking at right here. And she
held when we first had Jonah. She took care of him. She held him. And there's little pictures. We just hung out with this family. And I, you know, now she would try to pick, well, Jonah would probably pick her.
But I'm just saying. And
And so anytime I see this family, and there are several other people in here, no matter what skin they're wrapped in, then our first impulse is to hug.
Yes.
Right? And that look, that same impulse can look like, hey, what are you doing in the tree? Come here.
Exactly.
I'm having dinner. You need to get out the tree. Right?
Yes.
What did Bob Goff say? The weird people? That's going to be me. If you are going to engage with me, I'm going to be that weird person. But let's start there rather than be afraid of me, because I'm 6'2", about $3.15.
along with your wonderful question, so how many of you know Jerry Taylor?
Right,
preacher. I think he's the best preacher, period. Amazing. But he was living in Atlanta early on in this journey, going to our church. And so one day, I asked Jerry, we were having time together in my office, and I said, Jerry, I said, hey, man, I said, listen, you know, I understand. I just need to learn. And to Tim's point, it is very important for us to not put the burden of learning on one group, right? Think about this. If you know someone that has been abused, sexually abused, you wouldn't put all of the burden of learning on that person. Right? So when it comes to learning how to engage each other, cross culture, and, you know, more color, don't put all the learning on one person. Now, there's a lot that can be helped that way. But to this point, so I said to Jerry, look, man, I have questions I want to ask. I don't know how to ask them. I will use words that are offensive, but I don't know them. Right? I have ideas I think are important, but I'm going to learn they're not. And then I have other things I don't think are important, and you're going to teach me that they are. Would you be my conversation partner? And he said, yes. So that day, Jerry and I spent 5 hours together in my office, okay? Well, years later, I mean, like just a few years ago, I hear Jerry telling this exact same story, but from his perspective, okay? And the thing he remembered, other than that, was, and we finished on our knees, holding hands, praying together, and when Jerry got to that part of the story, Jerry was weak. So see, I didn't understand how much that would mean to Jerry. And that's because I hadn't lived Jerry's journey. Right? Jerry's one of the best leaders in my life. And I've told him, I said, many times, you tell me where to go, how far to walk, when to jump, and I would, because his heart is so pure and his mind is so wise. But I had to say to Jerry, I just don't know. And what I know might not be so. I need a conversation partner. You feel where I'm coming from on that? Right?
Mine here is more of a statement of education for you two. More than a question. My personal background is my biological mother's right. My biological father's next to my mom's left. A lot of people talk about that. I've experienced just living in all cultures. She's very consistent. And I appreciate your guys' ability and willingness to educate, because that's the most important. Because we know every little bit about each one of the cultures I live in, I literally gasp. And after based on which family I'm going to. So just educating yourself.
Self-educating ourselves is really important, right? And that's a lot of what's been happening to me. What's your name? Thank you for sharing. That's what's been happening to me for the last 20 years. And there's no one person along the way that gave gave me everything I needed to know. But all kinds of people are speaking into these guys. So here's what we're going to do. There's a class coming. So what we're going to do is we're going to dismiss. And there's books available out in the lobby if you'd like to get them. I want to thank you for coming today. And